This is Building Bridges, produced and hosted by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. Now a discussion on the making of global capitalism, the intimate relationship between modern capitalism and the American state, including its role as an informal empire promoting free trade and capital movements, with Leo Panitch, Canadian Research Chair in Comparative Political Economy at York University, and Sam Gindin, former Research Director of the Canadian Auto Workers Union and Professor at York University, co-authors of The Making of Global Capitalism, The Political Economy of American Empire.
Hi.
And congratulations on your new book. It's certainly heartbreaking. And I'd like to start with that. I'd like to give you an opportunity to lay out a synopsis of your theory of the informal American empire in the context of globalization. Leo?
Well, you know, most people, when they think of the word American empire, tend to think of it in terms of the United States acting in its own narrow self-interest and in the interest of its capitalists. And we're arguing that, in a way, that's misleading. That given the tendency of capitalist markets to expand and spread around the world, and in the absence of a global state, the American state has taken on the responsibility, some would say the burden, of acting as the core of this missing global state. And the American state, above all its financial state institutions, the Treasury, the Federal Reserve, have been especially important in creating the legal framework through free trade treaties, through international agreements around capital movements, through setting the legal framework for international markets that facilitate the spread of multinational corporations. The American state has played the central role of, in a sense, acting for all of global capital. And you see this very practically, that, you know, even in the middle of the world's greatest crisis since the 30s, the world's money has come to the United States. This has been the safe haven. Investors all around the world look to the American state, the Treasury, the Federal Reserve, as their ultimate protector. So when one hears of American empire, it's true. It's an informal empire. There's been no more powerful state in the history of the world. But it's not been the Pentagon and the CIA that's been at the center of it. It's been the Treasury and the Federal Reserve and the role that they've played for global capitalists everywhere. Of course, since U.S. capital and U.S. multinational corporations are so dominant in the world, it benefits them especially. But it's very important to see this American state role in a much broader context of global capitalism.
If I could pursue that a little, U.S. capital has certainly sought to set up client states that conformed and facilitated its profit-making schemes. And that was done, it would seem, by a combination of the use of capital and capital ideology in conjunction with the military might of the state. So help me understand what you're suggesting is different at this point, or is it really?
Well, it's different in the sense that as Leo was emphasizing, this isn't about the CIA and the Pentagon and the military and simply doing it by force. What you really have here is a specifically capitalist empire, specifically making a global capitalism. So it involves sovereign states and involves when the flow of capital is coming into the United States from other countries, it's not primarily because of force. It's because it's also in their interest. So what you're seeing here is the making of a global capitalism. A global capitalism isn't inevitable. Capitalists might have a tendency to want to expand, but whether they can actually achieve that expansion or not depends. It could be fragmented by states. And the role that the American state has played that is so important is that they've been able to internationalize other states. So other states as well see it as part of their responsibility to contribute to the making of global capitalism within their own territory.
Mimi, I just want to add that I think you're right to emphasize that this is sometimes done through coercion, some of it military or subversion. So some of it economic coercion, but that's usually done in a context where there are communist parties or socialist parties that want to close that country to capital accumulation, or that where there used to be, and there are hardly any of them around anymore, what used to be known as national capitalist classes that seek to accumulate behind tariff barriers and behind controls on capital movements. And the United States, when it intervenes, is often intervening on behalf of local capitalist classes that want to be part of the global capitalist context that Sam is speaking of. So, you know, we often speak of this as though the United States is intervening in Central America. Of course it is. But it's remember that it's intervening usually on behalf of local capitalists who want to maintain open links and, above all, their ability to invest freely in Florida or on Wall Street or wherever.
And would that be the case for the Middle East now, states
yes.
like Libya and so on?
Well, you know, you have to read it in each particular case, but very possibly so, yes.
This is a very rich historical work and deserves much fuller treatment, but I think given the fact that we're in an economic crisis right now, I'd really like to skip a bit to the present, although we might want to place that in historical perspective, and talk about how the present crisis falls within your idea and your theory of a new informal empire.
Well, I'll let Sam speak to that as well. You know, our last chapter is called American Crisis, Global Crisis. And it used to be the case that people would think that if there was a crisis in the United States, that meant that this was the decline of the American empire. Instead, this crisis, which was very much a made-in-America one, it was one rooted in the American housing market, and especially in the extent to which working people in the United States were dependent on credit, mortgage credit, borrowing indeed on their houses in order to keep their standard of living up, and also consumer credit, student credit, and so on. And that's what kept the American economy going when wages stagnated. But, you know, this was a made-in-America crisis, but it immediately spread around the world. And it spread around the world because of the deep networks of globalization that had occurred, including the buying of American municipal debt in, you know, Norway, by state banks in Germany, indeed all around the world. And moreover, the nature of integrated production and integrated investment now is such that when the American economy tanks, as it really does after a housing bubble bursts, because the whole construction industry is affected, the furniture industry is affected, etc., the nature of integrated production is such that the demand also turns down for those Chinese firms that are producing for Walmart. So both through investment linkages and through demand linkages, the effect of a crisis in the United States, which for a long time has been the consumer of last resort, has an enormous impact right around the world, and, of course, most extensively in Europe, because it is the other advanced capitalist states, Canada, the European states, Japan, that are most intimately linked with global investment, with American investment in the global economy.
Yeah, and just what Leo was saying about those links, you really see it in the mortgage market. A lot of the mortgages, including the subprime mortgages in the States, were funds that were coming into the United States from Europe. There's two parts of this that I would just really add to what Leo's saying. One of the assumptions the left has often made in the past is that when you have this kind of a crisis, it would lead to inter-imperial rivalry, or it was an example of decline of the U.S. In fact, what you see in this crisis is it's a crisis of capitalism. It hasn't led to those kinds of splits within the capitalist class. The conflicts that we see aren't between the capitalist classes of Germany and the United States, for example. And the other thing in terms of finance is you might think that this should lead to a split between finance and industry, given finance's critical role in this and the impact on industry. But in fact, finance and industry are themselves integrated. Finance isn't just speculative, even though there is a lot of speculation going on. It's also something that is absolutely necessary to making global capitalism. That's one of the problems with finance, that capitalism needs this kind of a crazy financial system to work. So it's interesting also that through this crisis, we haven't seen any splits in capital, really, between finance and industry. There might be some tensions, but we haven't seen those kinds of splits at all. So where this begins to take you politically is to look at the contradictions inside each state and the working out of whether there are political developments inside these states that can challenge this, because we aren't going to be saved by an alliance with some section of the bourgeoisie here or elsewhere that is splitting off and coming into conflict with American capital or with financial capital.
The advent of Occupy Wall Street, much of what was kind of in debate there, or the general mantra, was really that almost to completely negate the nation state in its entirety and just suggest that it was no longer a necessary entity or even handmaiden for capital, that we live in a plutocracy and in effect the global corporatocracy is where rule really lies. That is certainly not the premise within the context of your book. If you could just flesh it out for us a bit.
You've, I think, raised the central issue, Mimi. I think that a lot of people, in a sense, the zeitgeist of our time, the common sense of our time, especially among young activists, is exactly as you defined it. And yet it's very much the fact today. All the more, in fact, that you can't change the world without taking power. States are enormously important to the construction of contemporary power, so much so that, you know, if you think about it for half a second, it's not corporations that sign international trade agreements. It's not corporations that enter into the World Trade Organization. It's not corporations that sit on the executive board of the International Monetary Fund. It's states that do. And it's the state's representation of capital and the negotiations that they make amongst each other and with their subordinate classes in each of their societies that is crucial to the running of the modern world. And if people aren't able to get into the state and fundamentally change the state so that it isn't acting so as to facilitate the spread and maintenance of global capitalism and the containment of its inevitable crises, then we will go from one protest to another for the rest of eternity. That's not to say these protests aren't useful. It's not to say that they don't have some effect and politicians notice them and they create some fears on their side. But unless people can find a way of getting into the state and changing the state, and above all, the American state, that's why the whole world is watching, of course, this election, as it always does when an American election occurs. That's why it's so important. And it's very much in this context important, not only in the sense of, you know, fundamentally changing the world, but even important in terms of coming to certain reforms, which if the American state doesn't lead on, won't happen. And those reforms need to be about taking the banking system into the public sphere and making it a public utility, about direct government spending, and more public employment, because it's clear that the monetary policy of throwing money at the banks is not leading the banks to lend. It's not leading people to borrow because they're already over-leveraged with their credit. And it's not leading companies to invest. So unless the United States act, certainly other states won't. And it's enormously important this come on the agenda during this election campaign.
Just going back to the analysis of the state being irrelevant, when you look at General Motors, it's not that it's escaping the state when it goes abroad. It's actually becoming dependent on many states, on more states, you know, to reproduce the conditions for it to be able to be profitable, to control labor, etc. And in terms of the question, sometimes it takes people into what we really need is an international struggle, rather than a national struggle. And Marx commented on this in the Communist Manifesto, and he emphasized that the struggle is always, in substance, international, because whatever you do here affects things someplace else, it creates space someplace else. But he especially emphasized that the form of the struggle ends up to be national. You first have to come to terms with your own capitalist class, and that means dealing with political power through your state. And Leo's absolutely right that the political implications of grasping this are so important because it affects everything about how you define the political project and what you can do and how you can possibly move beyond protests of outside the state or just protesting corporations.
Leo, I'd like to come back to the banks because people would say, well, nationalizing the banks is totally off the table and we really can regulate them. Maybe we don't have the regulations in place we want now, but that's the direction to go. Can we regulate the banks in a way that will move things forward, or what's the alternative?
Well, I think that the mistake people make in this respect is to accept the language of deregulation. It was during the period of the New Deal-style regulation of the banks that the American banking system was nurtured back to health from having been in a perilous state after the 1929 crash. The separation between commercial and investment banking was the means whereby American investment banks, Goldman Sachs today, were able to develop because they were separated from commercial banking, to develop the expertise, the confidence, the capacity to go international as they did in the 1960s. And that was so profitable that commercial banks wanted to get into the business. And before long, they were skirting, and the Federal Reserve was facilitating it, all of those rules with regard to separation between commercial and investment banking. So, you know, when things got quote-unquote deregulated, that is when, say, the Glass-Steagall Act was removed, that was a matter of closing the barn door before the horse had already bolted. Finance had become so large, it had outgrown those New Deal regulations. The notion that you can return to those regulations is, it seems to be, completely mythical. Moreover, to keep international capitalism going, the role that the international financial system plays, not least through derivatives markets, which were at the core of the last crisis, is absolutely crucial. The derivative market in currencies alone is absolutely crucial to all of the flow of goods between China and the United States and all of the rest of the trade around the world. So unless we are able to take the banking system somehow, and I totally agree that there aren't the political forces to put this on the agenda right now, it's isolated voices that are calling for this. Unless we can take the banking system, and indeed banks were nationalized already in this crisis all over the place, including the United States, but they were given back then to the private sector. Unless we can take those nationalized banks, turn them into public utilities, and make them part of a democratic economic planning process, we will never get out of the contradictions and the crises that repeatedly are thrown up by them.
I completely agree with Leo. I think it's much more utopian to imagine that you can leave finance with this power and just regulate it than to actually start thinking about how you would actually take over the financial system and treat it as a democratic public utility. And if we don't put that on the agenda, you know, if we wait until the time is right, then we'll wait forever because the time will never be right. You have to start getting it on the agenda and talking about it now. And if you don't do that, then even reforms are going to be very difficult to carry out. We're going to need some control over the allocation of resources so we can do the kind of things that need to be done to not just get out of the crisis, but get out of the crisis in a way that doesn't just continue neoliberalism.
And just quickly, the immediate implications in terms of the economy. World War II took us effectively out of the Great Depression. I'm not asking for that discussion, but where do we go? Is it about simply more spending, a greater, more extensive stimulus that moves us forward? And we won't even get into the decimation of the trade unions. But both of you, just in maybe a minute apiece, please give us your understanding of what is to be done. What are the implications?
This isn't going to be fixed by monetary policy. Monetary policy can stabilize the banks, but it can't actually get people to spend. And the same with tax cuts. All of this is just like pushing on a string. What you need is massive direct spending on infrastructure, on public employment. But also, you have to start thinking about this in terms of this is also a moment where we're both trying to get out of a crisis, but also build some capacities for the future. So a lot of this should also be about restructuring power as we do this. So the banking example is one of this. But I also think there's a lot of things to think about in terms of the auto industry and a lot of the capacity that's sitting around unused that shouldn't go to more cars, but that should be converted.
Leo, 30 seconds. I hate to do that to you.
No, we're not going to get World War II again. And I think that's the crucial point, Mimi.
Well, that's one of the good things, yes.
That's one of the good things. And we're not going to get the kind of spending because of inter-imperial rivalry that produced World War II. So it is going to have to take a democratized state, a state that does undertake the kinds of things Sam was just talking about, which is going to involve direct government spending. And insofar as capitalists around the world are competing to give money to the United States, they're buying treasury bonds at a rate of interest that is lower than the rate of inflation. The American state has an enormous degree of room for maneuver, and it's ideological blackmail to suggest otherwise, an enormous amount of room for maneuver to engage in that kind of direct spending. And unlike 1940, 41, 42, it could be done not on military equipment, but on meeting people's basic needs.
You're great, both of you. And the book, I actually try to read it sitting in a canoe, which was not the
no, was not, first.
No, it wasn't the way to go.
Didn't get it wet.
Tip a canoe and meet a canoe.
Yes, but I want folks to really follow up with Leo and Sam. That is Leo Panitch and Sam Gindin. This is a deep, profound, rich book. Read it and absorb it, and it will help us create some new paths to follow in our effort to, yes, assume the people's power for substantive transformation. Leo Panitch, Sam Gindin, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Mimi and Kim.
It's the story of a place called Mushland. Mushland is a place where all the little mice lived and played, were born and died, and they lived much as you and I do. They even had a parliament. And every 4 years they had an election. They used to walk to the polls and cast their ballot. Some of them even got a ride to the polls. Got a ride for the next 4 years afterwards, too. Just like you and me. And every time on election day, all the little mice used to go to the ballot box and they used to elect a government. A government made up of big, fat, black cats. Now, if you think it's strange that mice should elect a government made up of cats, you just look at history and maybe you'll see that they weren't any stupider than we are. Now, I'm not saying anything against the cats. They were nice fellows. They conducted the government with dignity. They passed good laws. That is, laws that were good for cats. But the laws that were good for cats weren't very good for mice. One of the laws said that mouse holes had to be big enough so a cat could get his paw in. Another law said that mice could only travel at certain speeds so that a cat could get his breakfast without too much physical effort. All the laws were good laws for cats, but oh, they were hard on the mice. And life was getting harder and harder. And when the mice couldn't put up with it anymore, they decided something had to be done about it. So they went en masse to the polls. They voted the black cats out. And they put in the white cats. The white cats had put up a terrific campaign. They said all that Mouseland needs is more vision. They said the trouble with mouse land is those round mouse holes we've got. If you put us in, we'll establish square mouse holes. And they did. And the square mouse holes were twice as big as the round mouse holes. And now the cat could get both his paws in. and life was tougher than ever. And when they couldn't take that anymore, they voted the white cats out and put the black ones in again. And then they went back to the white cats, and then to the black cats. They even tried half black cats and half white cats. And they called that coalition. They even got one government made up of cats with spot bunnies. They were cats that tried to make a noise like a mouse, but they ate like a cat. You see, my friends, the trouble wasn't with the color of the cat. The trouble was that they were cats. And because they were cats, they naturally looked after cats instead of mice. Presently, there came along one little mouse who had an idea. My friend, watch out for the little fellow with an idea. And he said to the other mice, look, fellas, why do we keep on electing a government made up of cats? Why don't we elect a government made up of mice? Well, he said, he's a Bolshevik. Lock him up. So they put him in jail.
But I want to remind you that you can lock up a mouse or a man, but you can't lock up an idea.
The story of Mouseland was narrated by Tommy Douglas, leader of the Saskatchewan Cooperative Commonwealth Federation, and later the New Democratic Party of Canada, both social democratic parties.
Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash, and log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.